Hey there, foreigners. This is Rohit from BreakingTheBorders.com, home of the ambitious immigrants. Today's guest is Karan Bajaj. Karan is an executive from corporate America who decided to leave his job and travel the world in 2008. In his year-long sabbatical, he wrote a book called Keep Off the Grass, which became a best-selling book in India with more than 150,000 copies sold. He returned to corporate America and he took two other such sabbaticals to write two more books since 2008. Today, he's here to talk about why it's important to take a sabbatical even if you're not a writer, how to go about taking a sabbatical, why is it important to have specific goals when taking time off. He also talks about his process of writing. Is it the process that he enjoys or the outcomes? And what are some of the best books for writers and many more? Here is my interview with Karan.
Karan, welcome to Breaking the Borders podcast.
I'm honored to be here, Rohit.
Thank you so much for being here. And you are a very multifaceted personality, right? So you have a lot of interest in several different aspects. So I'm curious to know, how do you typically introduce yourself?
Oh, great question. I think basically the two, I guess, predominant things that I'm interested or deepening myself in is writing. So I introduced myself as a novelist who's written a couple of best-selling novels in India and has just had my first international release with Random House a month ago in May. The Yoga of Max's Discontent. So one identity, I guess, is a novelist. And the other is I've been also pretty deep in my corporate career. So I'm the chief marketing officer of in my latest avatar, I was the chief marketing officer of a startup.
I see. Yeah. So there is this other aspect which I see you write and talk a lot about, which is the spiritual side of things, meditation and the yoga portion of it. So do you associate yourself with that identity much? Or?
Yeah, very much. I think of myself as like a striving yogi. You know, the whole idea of a yogi is that he's trying to eliminate all sense of self and ego and just trying to become a medium for his work to express himself. And I think I'm kind of a little bit on that journey in which I'm trying to be just a channel for my work in some way, you know? Yeah.
When did you first get attracted to spirituality?
The strange thing is that I've been always attracted to it quite a bit. In like even when I was growing up, I was always being pulled into Bhagavad Gita, the Buddhist text, Vipassana. So I think some part of it is like call it past lives or some. There's always been a pull that my family didn't have. I always had a pull, but I think I didn't go very deep into it until very, very recently. I think the trigger, not in very linear way, but I think the trigger was that when my mom had a very dramatic decline with cancer. So she was only 54 or 55 when she had cancer, and over 2 years, she went through a very dramatic decline. And I think during that period, all the questions that start a spiritual search on what is suffering? Why do humans suffer? What is the nature of suffering? Why is the world created if this is the nature of what life is about? I think all those questions became very personal and urgent in a way that it was earlier a very intellectual kind of pursuit.
When was this? Which year was this?
2010 was when my mom truly when my mom passed away. The whole thing lasted from 2008 to 2010. Mm-hmm. So until then, I would say my, experiments with spirituality were very intellectual. And then once that happened, it became very urgent for me to really understand what it meant, life meant, and why everything happens and all that stuff. Yeah.
So I want to get into the writing portion of it and the sabbaticals that you took. But before I do that, I'm really curious to know, what was your childhood like?
Childhood, for the most part, is characterized by the fact that my dad was in the Indian Army. So it was a very wandering childhood in which we moved every 2 years. So in the 12 years of schooling, I changed like 13 schools. So we moved a lot. But our home base was up in the mountains, in the Himalayas, in Shimla, like at the foothills of the mountains in Shimla. Which I think has got something to do with some of my interests and stuff that I've come up later in life.
So you mentioned somewhere that you would often see people who leave their corporate jobs and come to the ashrams when you're growing up. Was that right? And did that have an impact?
Very much. And like the surprising thing is that if you grew up in my generation in India, so I grew up in the 80s in India, we would actually look down upon spirituality, yoga, meditation. Like, very contrary to what Westerners think, that every Indian is like very into, like, you know, like, when we were growing up in India, we would think of that as a bit of a loser pursuit.
Yeah.
Because we were all trying to get out of India and like go, like, you know, make our money and all that stuff. So, but during that time when I was growing up, a lot of people used to keep coming, like, Indians as well as Westerners. And they would either live in some Baba's ashram nearby or even up a little bit higher in caves they started to live. And they were very remote and puzzling creatures. Like, we never really, I didn't really aspire to the yogic life then at all.
Mm-hmm.
So they were just very like detached curiosity. And we would all be like, why is he doing that sort of a thing?
And they would also like beg for food and stuff, which will kind of make them, I mean, you look down upon them in a way for that reason. I mean, I did in my hometown when I was growing up, at least.
Right. Like, the guys that came up to the Himalayas were not that destitute, because they were lawyers, doctors, engineers. Like, they were pretty intelligent people. They were not like the Babas that you think of, like, who can't like communicate properly or whatever, or just like, you know, have these guys were like intellectuals who had decided to do that. So they had relinquished a lot of their belongings, but mm-hmm. on the other hand, they had kept enough to be self-sustaining. And then also the villagers in that area used to make sure that they gave their offerings and all that stuff. Like, I never saw them as like people who were struggling with money. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, they felt very unusual, because it felt like, you know, they had everything. Why were they doing this?
Yeah. So in spite of this seed of spirituality or this unconventional life as a childhood, in most of your formative years, you had a very standard Indian upbringing in a way, right? So you went to good schools, you got a good degree. How did that happen?
For our generation, it was almost it was forced by the conditions that we had to, like, in order to have any kind of sensible livelihood, we had to go through engineering college and, like, you know, the usual stuff. So I ended up doing engineering college, business school, because it's almost like in India, we don't think for the first 21, 22 years of a life about what meaning is, what purpose is. You're just following the system that somebody set out for you.
Yeah.
So I was kind of just doing that. So I just didn't have any, thought process at all about what I wanted or whether I wanted something different or not.
Looking back, do you support it?
Surprisingly enough, when I came here, I didn't support it.
Mm-hmm.
But now when I look at my wife, who's Irish-American, who's Irish and she was born in New Jersey and stuff, and I see her friends and herself, I've started to realize that there is some merit in a system in which you're not allowed to make very big decisions until your mind is mature enough.
Mm.
Because I think what I'm seeing in the US, at least with my wife's friends, is that they are making very big decisions about where they should, what, why, like, live education stream they should pursue, whether at age 15, 16, or whether they should drop out of college and go do teach for America, at a stage when they're not mature enough to make those decisions. As a result, what happens is that there is a hugely delayed adulthood. So they don't kind of find out their real streams that they should be working on till their early or mid 30s,
mm-hmm.
when they're also encumbered by heavy loans. And like the whole system is like, it leads to a lot of unhappiness then, at a later stage, because you've been drifting for so long. In our case, I think you're a little bit almost trained to make big decisions when you're very mature.
Mm-hmm.
So like after engineering and business school, I went to corporations and then I started to write and then I started to travel and then I started to take sabbaticals, but I didn't have, like, it was very rational decision making without the baggage of any loans and any encumberments at all. So I think there's some merit in a little bit of maturity before you make very big decisions.
Yeah, but I wanted to dig on one point that you mentioned, which is forcing to make such decisions earlier will delay your adulthood. You would imagine by making adult-like decisions earlier would actually make your adulthood come early, right? So you're saying it will delay your maturity. How does that happen?
Because what ends up happening, at least what I've noticed, is that people make a lot of soft choices. And I think part of adulthood is about impulse control and delayed gratification and not making easy choices.
Mm.
So when you're 15 and you like to study and you like to read novels, you make the decision to go and study English literature for 3 years. That's a very easy decision. The harder decision is that, that comes easily to me, but perhaps the harder course here might be to study like a business-like field, which can round up my skills and get me both my left brain and my right brain versus just my right brain. But you're not making those hard decisions. You're making very easy decisions. So in that way, I feel like the test of adulthood is this, like, harder decisions that you don't end up making.
So you're forced to, when you're making decisions as a kid, you're practicing the muscle of making decisions as a kid, and that will kind of prolong your kiddishness.
Right, exactly. Yeah, because you're making easy, like, you know, like it's the cookie in the hand.
Got
so
it.
You're constantly choosing the cookies that are in your hand at that moment. So, like, you know, it's very, so what ends up happening is that you've never really faced very hard choices, and then, but you have to. This is life, so you will face the hard choices. That ends up happening in your 30s when you're suddenly $200,000 in debt and you have a $20,000 and a year job. There's no way out. That's when you start to make very hard decisions. And then I feel like, you know, like it's a different paradigm.
Mm-hmm. It's late and it could be avoided. Yeah, that's a very interesting perspective. I haven't heard it this before, but it makes perfect sense the way you put it. So you wrote your first novel in 2008.
Yeah.
Right? And coming to the world, it seems like an overnight thing. So suddenly you came out of nowhere and wrote this novel. Yeah. But I know from a creator's perspective, like creating this podcast or whatever, that it's a long journey. So I'm curious to know, not just for the novel itself, but even before you decided to start writing the novel, what was your personal growth journey like? Maybe from 2002, since you got your job, to like 2007, what was your journey in those years?
Yeah. Excellent question. So let me take two parts of the question separately. I would almost say that the novel was truly an overnight success. Like, I can credit no hard work at all to the success of the novel, because to the writing and the success of the novel. Having said that, I do believe that in writing, you have to pay your dues. I ended up paying my dues in my third novel. It's a long story, but the truth about the first novel is that I wrote it without having any idea at all about how to write a novel, novel structures. I'd never read a book on novel writing. I just had read books and I felt like I could write. So I started writing and I finished my book in, I think, 6 months of part-time writing. Mm-hmm. And within a month of me finishing it, I had Harper, Penguin and Rupa, which were the three top publishers in India, all three bid for it. And I sold the rights to HarperCollins. So it's almost like the dream overnight success that you can think of did happen in my first novel. Mm-hmm. Having said that, journey...
So how did that happen? Like, was it all chance, you were saying?
A lot of it was, the fact was that between 2002 and 2008, a couple of things happened. I took a job, my first job. I chose to take my first job in Philippines. So suddenly I moved from India, where I'd spent my whole life, had a lot of friends and family, to a very remote part of Philippines where I knew nobody at all, didn't speak the language at all. And it was my first kind of true, experience with loneliness. Till then, I'd never known what loneliness truly meant. Yeah. And to be alone for long periods of time. Suddenly what started happening was that I started to hike as a result. I started to scuba dive. I started to realize that, oh, I like traveling, and I didn't even know that I could hike, and I was a good hiker and I could run long distances. And I was like, oh, this is so liberating, that when all your, all conditioning is deconstructed completely, you start to come closer to who you are. So then I started to systemize that, and I was like, okay, the next job I'm going to take is not going to be, I took it in Singapore. Then I took it in Europe. Then I went to the US. I kept choosing those assignments that nobody wanted in PNG, and just because I was loving this idea of being alone and traveling, and I would like travel a lot and do tough things to push myself. I hiked tremendously, mm-hmm. almost all the mountains in Asia, then Kilimanjaro. Like, I hiked very much in that period. And so all that was happening.
In all that adventures, any one particular journey that you would like to share about? Any particular trip?
A couple of things that stand out a lot was Kilimanjaro, mm-hmm. and Machu Picchu, like mountains where, I think what stands out in that period was really those moments in which I felt the complete kind of dissolving of myself and being completely in that activity. And that was like in very tough hikes or in like a silent meditation retreat for 10 days. Things where I was just completely dissolving my sense of self. And I realized that when I came back from that experience, I was very transformed and changed. I could almost see how much I'd grown. Mm-hmm. So I started to kind of like evolve this idea that a vacation has to be a spiritual pursuit in which you, kind of like dissolve yourself completely. So I decided that I would never take a vacation which was easy. So I chose very hard vacations because those are the vacations in which I had no sense of self left at all because I was so in the moment, so concentrated, so meditative in the moment. Mm-hmm. So all those, like I would say, harder vacations versus the easier one, like backpacking through Europe, frankly, doesn't even stand out to me because it was too simple almost. And then like the hard ones stand out more to me.
I see.
Because there was very meditative focus happening there, which was evolving and transforming me. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so the point being, I did that totally out of a will to grow, transform, deconstruct. And then I started writing. Like, so then I had took a sabbatical in which I was just traveling. And then I just started to kind of pen down my thoughts in a novel form.
When was your first sabbatical?
Same time, 2007. So that's when I wrote. 2007. Yeah, I was in the middle of like, kind of like your, I did South America. So I was Brazil and I crossed over from Brazil to Peru through the Amazon. Went down Amazon through the bus all through Peru to Machu Picchu. Very hard kind of journey. And during that time, I was feeling like you'll also realize, or maybe not anymore, but at that time, every hostel I would go to, I was the only Indian. They had never seen an Indian before. So I started to feel that, oh, I'm having this very interesting experience that would be very relevant for people like me in India,
yeah,
who never had the imagination to even think that all this was possible to them. Yeah. So that's why I wrote purely because I was like, maybe 10 or 12 people will read it and like feel ki they should be able to do that.
What did you start with? What was your first writing? Was it the novel itself or were you writing something else?
No, I just wrote, like, I just started writing a novel about this very kind of trippy road journey through India, essentially.
Yes. Keeping off the grass, you're talking about.
The grass, yeah. So it was like about drugs and like all that kind of stuff through India, like a very road trip through India. Mm-hmm. Very inspired by my travels because I was like, that would be a very good impetus for someone to get that thrust to do it.
Since you brought up the sabbatical topic, let's talk about it. Why do you think it's important to take a sabbatical?
Because the biggest reason I feel is that there are a lot of tangible benefits that come to it that we can talk later. But I think the biggest reason is that you have to deconstruct completely from time to time. Because even if you are very yogic or Buddhist in your living, you end up starting to have identities like, I like vegetarian food, I like green juices, I like this. Like, you start to create preferences around your life. Mm-hmm. I want to shop at Whole Foods. Like, even at a very basic level, you start to have preferences. And I think that kind of limits who your conditioning or definition of yourself as a human is. And with a sabbatical, I think what happens is that I deconstruct completely. There is no idea of preferences left at all. I'm just like, for example, now that we are with our kids, the next sabbatical we are planning is to spend 4 months in an orphanage in Cambodia working with our hands. Like, you know, truly as a family working together and doing something. Now, I know that like it's so unfamiliar to me that I'll have to create completely new patterns, completely new routines. As a result, some part of me is going to completely die and a new part will emerge. So I think it's part of the, that's the only way I feel that you can truly deepen as a person versus being in your comfort zone.
I see. You know? So when you say deconstruct, strip away the conditioning, like you said earlier.
Yeah. Conditioning, habits, patterns, behaviors, your feeling of who you are, your, your culmination of what you've defined yourself as.
What is among the tangibles? You were saying that we can talk about a tangible later. What is a tangible benefit that one can get?
The tangible benefit that happens to me is that I'm very analytical by nature because I'm forced in the sabbatical to become very intuitive by choice. Like if I'm going to Cambodia without a plan and have to set up my family, it's very spontaneous decision making constantly. Mm-hmm. Every day is a spontaneous decision making. So you come back after a year of doing that, you can just see the output, whether you're writing, you'll start to see much more spontaneity creep into every part of your life.
I see.
So I think that's one very tangible benefit that I see when I come back. I'm very spontaneous. Then the other thing is when you are in hard conditions, you start to realize how much depth you have as a person, right? So you come back and you're like, you're never going to complain because somebody in office said something, right? Because you've slept on a train station for 3 days. So, or you've said, like in our last sabbatical, we were in an ashram for 4 months, sleeping on a floor, having a cold shower every day. So when you come back and you're like, what am I complaining about? So you're just like, you just deepen.
Different perspective.
Yeah. And you can kind of deepen what you're capable of.
So there is this one idea of when you're going for a vacation or when you're going for a long-term travel. There is this Indiana Jones style of breaking the bridge that you came on so that there is no way to go back versus what you mostly do, which is talk to your people at work and take a sabbatical, try to get. So have you ever thought about this other way where you're fully vested and why have you not chosen that way and chosen the way that you do it?
Because the biggest reason I do that is because I want no pressure in the sabbatical to be productive in the conventional sense. So I feel like that if I go from I'm breaking this and now I'm going to become a full-time travel writer, or I don't know, like some fantasy of like a full-time writer, then the automatic thing that will happen in the sabbatical is that I have to be productive because I've left my job. I've left this. Now I have to start monetizing this. So I have to think about, will my blog get this visitors and that visitors? And like, then you kind of lose this whole idea of conscious goallessness, which is what I want in the sabbatical. So I think that's been the primary impetus. Now, if I evolve to a point where I feel that I can take this plunge without thinking at all about, how to like believing that at maybe 15, 18 months later, some answer will come on how money will come into my life and all that. But I haven't like reached that point yet. So now I feel like it's very liberating to me to know ki acha, I'll go back after 12 months and I'll have some kind of a job, or at least I'm going back to this idea of a job. That allows me to be very free in my sabbatical and just explore whatever I want to explore.
I see. And in some sense, you are saying that it's maybe a more advanced move to do that.
For me, at least, because like, for instance, if I look at the last sabbatical, for 9 months, I didn't write a single word.
The last sabbatical in 2012?
2012. We were traveling for a year, out of which for the first 3 months, we were Europe to India by road. There was nothing. We were just drifting. Mm-hmm. Then we reached India, 6 months in an ashram doing yoga, meditation. I didn't write a word for 9 months. Then in 3 months, when I came back in Portugal, I really had this intense need to write. So I wrote in Portugal nonstop and I had the book ready. Now, if I think of taking a sabbatical being like, okay, now I'm becoming a writer, I can't imagine 9 months of not writing then. I think I lose that whole idea of like goallessness completely and being following my gut on what I want to do.
So when you left your job to go to the sabbatical in 2012, you did not sign up for the ashram to do the teacher training 3 months later, or you did not sign up to the Portugal writing course. You went out there thinking, okay, let's see what comes up. And along the way, you decided to sign this.
Kind of, exactly. A small one was that I have a little bit of an anchor that I really wanted to learn yoga and meditation, but not the particular course and the particular ashram. But I had a little bit of an anchor that I really think this is something that's to be very good for my next phase of my life. So both my wife and I wanted to really learn that. So it was more like principles, but not the plan.
Got it. So that's a good point that you mentioned. I wanted to learn a little bit more about that, because taking a sabbatical is an extremely daunting task, right?
So the whole
world is open from the, I'm 29 now, and for the past 29 years, my schedule has been structured, and it was very productive. I cleared JEE, I went to IIT, I got good education, I came to the US. Like, it's been very useful, this construct. But not having that construct for a brief period is extremely daunting in some sense.
Yes.
So how do you balance freedom versus having some structure?
No, I think it's actually wonderful to have a balance of freedom and structure, because I think it's beautiful if you go with a little bit of, like, I knew at the back of my mind that I wanted to write a novel and I wanted to learn yoga and meditation. So I think that gave a lot of thrust to the sabbatical, because even when I was going from Europe to India by road, I always had this feeling that I was researching. So that was always very active in my mind. So if I was in a hostel in Bulgaria, I would speak a lot to people and really understand their journeys. Like, I was always in my research mode, because I knew that at some point I would have an output of a novel.
I see.
And like, when we went to do yoga and meditation, we quickly said, let's do teacher's training, because that's how we'll really learn in depth versus just doing some ashram dabbling here and there. So it was very good to have some constructs versus being like, let's travel. Because I think let's travel can be very, like, I don't know, very boring for someone who's very goal-oriented, I think, in some way. Because, like, I remember in my first sabbatical, I was very depressed after 3 months. Because I was like, is this what I was planning all my life for? To go and see a cathedral in Rome and see a cathedral in Germany and see a cathedral? Like, I don't want to see any more 18th century castles, because I'm not interested in it, you know?
Yeah.
So, I felt very anchorless.
So it took some while for you to kind of figure this out even. So in the first sabbatical, you did not do it, is it?
The first sabbatical was like almost a disaster for the first 3 months because I had this lifelong fantasy that I want to travel. And then I was living that fantasy and it was very lonely and depressing because I was like moving from hostel to hostel and relationships were very transitory that I was forming and I was seeing things but not really feeling that I was like it didn't really matter to me that I was seeing a cathedral here. Like it didn't really touch me in any way. And so then I think that it was good to have that experience because then after that I was like, I've learned two things. One, I have to stay longer in a place and B, I have to learn something. It just started to become very clear to me. And then I spent 3 months actually in Brazil and Peru, Brazil writing a little, like that's when I started to write the novel.
So on your first sabbatical, you were by yourself?
By yourself, all alone. Yeah, yeah.
All alone. Completely,
yeah.
So you didn't meet your wife at that time?
No,
all
no,
by yourself.
No, no, I was all by myself. It was very lonely and depressing almost. Then I went to Mongolia because I always thought I would live, wanted to go to Mongolia, which was even more lonely because it was like just sad to be in Mongolia and like
by yourself that too.
By yourself and do nothing. And like, you know, so I was very like, so, but it was very good because after 3 months I started to realize that, okay, now the writing gave me a lot of then center because then I would be writing for 3-4 hours. Then I would do a little sightseeing, talk to people. Everything became very wonderful then because I was in the construct of writing a novel. So it was, I think it's very good to have some structure, some goal with freedom, with not such a goal-driven mentality though, that you go and create another life, you're just creating your
another job.
Same thing exactly outside. So, yeah.
How long was your first sabbatical?
I intended for it to be 12 months. I came back after 9.
Yeah. So a couple of practical questions. You talked at length about how much you spend on your sabbatical with your wife. But in the first sabbatical, which you did by yourself, do you remember how much you had to spend in the 9 months?
No, I don't remember. But I think I overspent a little because we weren't very seasoned travelers by then. So
you were by yourself, right? In 2007?
Yeah, I was by myself. And I think I overspent a little bit. Like I feel like, for example, like a good backpacker should never rent a car. Right, like stuff like that. I mean, I rented a car in Europe or something like that, which was a bad move.
I see.
Because cross-country car rental pricing goes crazy.
I see.
So small stuff like that. I think, you know, I was just a rookie, a travel rookie. So I wasn't a seasoned enough backpacker.
I see. No. So you were 9 months, you were solely dependent on your savings at that time.
Correct. Exactly. But now this sabbatical was very beautiful because anytime we would feel tense about spending too much money, there would be this 10-day silent Vipassana retreat for free.
I was talking about the 2007. That was completely based on your savings.
Yeah, completely based.
Because you were by yourself. So what did you do at the end of the 2007 sabbatical?
Yeah, so at the end of the 2007 sabbatical, I left Procter & Gamble. I came back in 2008 when the economy was just crashing.
Came back to where?
To my sister's place in Washington, D.C. because I had no home at all because I was living in Cincinnati, I think, with PNG. I left PNG and I put all my bag with my sister's place in her basement and I just left. So I came back to her place and the job market was horrible then. And only McKinsey and BCG were hiring. So I applied to them and then eventually got a job at BCG.
Now, practically, like, what visa did you have that allowed you to come back?
Well, I had a green card immediately.
Oh, you had a green card by that time.
Yeah, I had a green card in 2007 because that was part of the... the idea was to get a green card because it allowed a little bit of ease.
I see. Not so that you could come back to the US and find
a
job when you wanted to.
Yeah. And then the last sabbatical, I was waiting for my citizenship because that really made my life so much easier.
How is it easier with the citizenship?
Because you don't have to take a visa anywhere.
Ah, yes.
Because I was stuck in Brazil on the border and the Amazon with mosquitoes biting me because I didn't have a visa to Peru. Uh-huh. So I had to wait for 10 days at the Brazilian border for them to process the visa to Peru because I was crossing by boat to Peru and I was dying because for 10 days, like in that hot, humid border with nothing to do, just waiting for the paperwork to come through.
So you were on a boat waiting for the visa to come to you?
Not on the boat. Like I had a Brazilian visa, but not a Peruvian visa.
I see.
So I was at the Brazil station in Manaus, like just trying to get all
the
paperwork.
And the embassy was right there near the port?
The embassy was right there, but they had to send the paperwork to Rio.
Okay.
Which takes 4-5 days. So I was just like waiting.
Oh. Wow.
So stuff like that happened so much that I was like convinced that the next sabbatical would, like, so I was very driven to get US citizenship because after that, like, I can't even tell you it's a dream because you don't need, like, you can go any, like, we plotted all the way from Europe to India with
no visa requirement.
No visa at all required.
I see. With an Indian passport, it would have been much harder
it's
to do.
Nothing. Like, we could have gotten, like, I couldn't have gone to Bulgaria. I don't know. Like, I would have probably gotten a Euro visa.
Yeah.
But then couldn't go to UK, like couldn't go to Scotland, couldn't go to Bulgaria, like, yeah. Like then the Europe to India by road would never have happened.
I see.
but it's still fun, you know, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there is an adventure in that in itself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Getting visas is an adventure in itself. Yes.
What is a 414 rule?
I mean, I've come up with it in retrospect, honestly, which is I've seen that what happens with me is that around a 2.5-3 year mark, I start to get very, I feel that life is very predictable, very conditioned. I start to rebel against life. So now I've kind of systemized this idea that after 3 years, I'll start planning for one. And somewhere between the third and the fourth year, I'll take a year off. Mm-hmm. So 4 years of working, 1 year of off, 4 years of working, 1 year of off. Mm-hmm. So that's my kind of current thinking on the model.
On the model of how you want
to take it. Yeah, because then I'm accepting the fact that then there's no like disgruntled, like I'm just very accepting the fact that I'll be working with a lot of devotion for 2 years and then I'll start to get restless and like, you know, it's accepting like who I am, you know. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So when you talk about asking for a sabbatical,
yeah,
right, you mentioned 3 points. One is be exceptional at what you do. Second, yeah, one is be goals, have a specific, yeah, goal with urgency, like I want to do 1 year of yoga teacher training or, yeah, whatever, yeah, very specific goal. And then what is the third one I'm missing here? But my question was more on the first one. So you say like being exceptional at job. The last few months of your job,
yeah,
you know you're going to take a sabbatical,
right,
whether it's approved or not, right? In some,
yeah,
way.
Yeah, yeah.
So how do you stay motivated to continue to be exceptional?
It's a good question. I think you start to get looser. So that's true. You do start to loosen up a little bit. But I don't know. I think like the for me, that's why it grounds me to know that I'll come back.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that like my net worth is my network or whatever, all that stuff, you know, that I know that like my network is everything,
uh-huh,
when I come back. So my reputation matters a lot.
Yeah.
But if I was going with now that I'm going to become like this full-time travel writer, then I would be like, oh, it doesn't matter. I'll let me burn all my bridges. But knowing that I have to have a re-entry back and these people will be responsible for the re-entry, I think makes you a little bit more practically conscientious, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when you are doing unconventional things like this, right? So where you write, you have a spiritual side of it.
Yeah.
There are many opportunities that come your way and, yeah, a lot of them seem very interesting.
Yeah.
So my wife has this question for you, which is, how do you manage this barge of opportunities and interests versus, yeah, focus? Because focus, yeah, is also important on one field to go deeper, right?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think it's a very, very good question. I mean, I struggle with it constantly. Now with this new novel coming out, the reviews are very good. Sales have been very good for the first month in the US. It's all surprising because I'm a debut novelist in the US and it's like, despite not too much press, it's just taking off. So there's obviously a temptation because like, you know, you're being called for many conferences to speak and give this lecture and that lecture. I think what I've realized is that once you have a little bit of success in something, the very thing that makes you successful is also the thing that can
bring you down.
Bring you down, right? Like Tendulkar is wonderful when he says that like it's all about cricket. Cricket will get him a lot of attention, but then if he starts reveling in the attention, then he'll forget his cricket, but that's the reason why everything came his way. So I start to kind of think about the fact that the very boring jobs that, and I don't even find my jobs boring, but like the boring corporate life gives me the impetus to write whatever I want to write because I've never written for any audience except myself. Like I've always truly written to answer my questions and hope to get published as a result. And so I start to realize that like, you know, those very conventional structures are the ones that are allowing me to do, to be creative in a way that I've not seen full-time creatives be.
Mm.
So all the guys, yeah, it like 2008, a bunch of us started writing together in India. And because it was a kind of a, like a huge movement in India that everybody was like, all these professionals were writing. And when I look at people who became full-time writers, they've just written about the same stuff again and again.
Mm.
The same shallow well is again and again mined for college love stories and this love and that love. And while I see my first novel and my third novel, and I see, again, it doesn't matter whether people, like, the point is that I see those three novels and I'm like, oh, wow, like, my ideas have changed completely. And that for me is very, like I said, that's the most satisfying thing about my whole writing journey.
Let's talk about writing. Were you a writer as a kid?
Not really. Not at all, I would say. And I won't even say my first novel can be called a true novel. Like, it was successful, but to be honest, like, it doesn't, like, it can't truly be called a novel in its true form.
When did you start getting attracted to this idea of writing as a, step back and ask you more clearly. So writing has one aspect of, I want to produce a beautiful piece, right? So there is an artistic output. So there is people who are attracted to that output. But you, in my view, seemed like someone who was attracted to the process more than the output.
Yeah.
Did I see that correctly?
It's both. It's a great question. I've always felt that my writing has two pillars, entertainment and meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And once I crack those two, then I feel I'm really cracked a novel.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I just focus on meaning, which is the internal kind of, like, you know, like in this novel, I had a very deep quest for meaning. I was trying to answer through my writing, what does enlightenment mean? What is moksha? What is nirvana? Can a flesh and blood man, can the Buddha's journey be modern and contemporized? And that was a very meaningful, deep question that I wanted to answer through my writing. But if I just focused on that, then I think I would end up writing like some kind of a PhD thesis or all the non-fictiony books that you see.
Mm.
The entertainment pillar grounds me wonderfully because that, I think, shifts the focus a little bit to the reader, in which I'm like, how do I keep the reader up all night as they are kind of wrestling with this question of meaning, but they can't put it down because it's turning, the pages are turning so fast.
Mm-hmm.
So then I always put, so in this case, the meaning was very deep, but the entertainment is like this guy on a crazy kind of journey in which he goes through very hidden night markets and surreal ashrams and like caves up in the Himalayas. It's a very page turning novel.
Yeah. I'm curious to know why did you first think of in 2007 after three months in Mongolia and other European places, after getting bored, why did you think of expressing yourself as a writer in writing? You could have spoke or you could have introspected.
Yeah.
You know, there are many other outlets of
I was a reader. I think that made it a little bit, writing became a natural choice because I read a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was always a reader. And then I started to feel I could write. I think that was because it was just the medium that I was very
attracted to,
like in a way that I've not been attracted to. Like, I don't watch television that much, or I'm so obsessed by movies, for instance, but I've always liked reading a lot.
I see.
So I felt I could write. Yeah.
So you mentioned in some interview out there that you were, when you wrote your first novel, all the experience you had was some rejected short stories.
Yeah, one reject. Some not even, like, I would say one rejected short story in like engineering college, in which the standard is very low.
Uh-huh.
So like it's not like there was no, like it's not even like the New Yorker rejected me.
I see.
Like the engineering college magazine rejected me out of it. Like they must have rejected like one story in their entire, because they probably got like three submissions. So I was pretty bad. Like, you know, yeah. So I think what happened was that truly, as I started to live a big life,
mm-hmm.
I think the writing, like, so that's been my imperative even now, which is, how do I live a big, interesting life?
Was Keep Off Grass your first writing project?
Yeah, it was truly the first writing project. Yeah, yeah.
I see. So, what was the timeline like for you, for Keep Off Grass, which was published in 2008? You talked at length about the timeline for Max's Discontent, but you didn't talk much about the Keep Off Grass.
So yeah, Keep Off the Grass was very quick, honestly. It was 2 months of full-time writing in this sabbatical. After 3 months, I started to write for 2 months, then didn't write for again 2 months and stuff. So 2 months of full-time writing. And then I would say 3-4 months of part-time writing after I came back and joined BCG.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like chipping away at the writing after work.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, I would say, net, just 6 months of writing overall.
I see. And then you put it up for, you mentioned earlier, for bidding, and then
So what happened was Go ahead.
I'm curious to know, why did you publish in India, not here? Because you were here at that time, right?
Yeah, because I wrote a very Indian story.
I see.
And at some part of me knew that it wasn't very high quality. Like, I knew that it wasn't extremely literary, high quality like not to say that, it almost makes me feel saying that India's low quality like literature would be, I just felt it was very right for India.
I see.
For my generation of people who were reading about, like, they should, I was like thinking that nobody had written a story for my generation about drugs and sex and travel and motorcycle rides, and like nobody had written that kind of a story. And I felt like that genre had been really done very well in the US.
Mm-hmm.
It, like from Catcher in the Rye to Jay McHenry's book, like that genre has been, I read like Motorcycle Diaries and stuff, like those genres have been very popular in the US, on the road, Jack Kerouac. So I thought like nobody had tried that in India. So it felt very natural to do it. Yeah.
So now the movie, the book is being made into a movie, right?
The second novel is actually being gonna, Johnny Gone Down is.
I thought even Keep of the Grass was sold to a Hollywood production house.
Yeah. Keep of the Grass was sold to Hollywood first. Nothing happened because for like, so what happens is, like, just to give you a sense, is that less than 10% of novels that are optioned reach pre-production. And then 2% actually get made into movies.
I see.
So it's a very, like, a lot of novels get optioned, but very few get made into true films, in which, because there's so much investment in a film, that people really buy the novel to turn it into a script. Once you get the script, and then the script has to be, you have to have a star associated with it and all that stuff. Now, Keep of the Grass has been brought by an Indian, studio. We're pretty, like, it's just very recent. This Anil Kapoor has just brought the rights, so.
I see. He bought the rights from the Hollywood house.
Yeah, he brought that rights lapse for the Hollywood house, and I've just sold it to the Indian.
Oh, I see.
So nice. Keep up the grass. But Johnny is pretty exciting because I think that will be shooting soon. So I'm pretty excited about that. They're making the announcements in the next few weeks or months, I think.
So I'm familiar with Keep up the Grass, what it is about. You said it's about an Indian guy who has this foray into drug sex and other things. What was Johnny Go Deep about?
Johnny Go Down was my attempt to write a Forrest Gump. I was very attracted by Forrest Gump, about an ordinary man who is faced with extraordinary circumstances. And keeps, so I was kind of like very, I was very excited by that kind of a novel. So Johnny Gone Down is about an ordinary MIT guy, Indian MIT guy, who gets caught in a civil war in Cambodia, becomes a drug lord in Brazil, becomes a monk in Thailand, becomes a software millionaire in Silicon Valley. So he has this very Forrest Gumpish kind of adventure. In a more, yeah, like emotional way, because it's because of his wrong choices that he keeps building things and crashing them. And like, it was very, surprising thing was that I actually came back after the sabbatical, couldn't find a job for a few months, was regretting why I went on a sabbatical, found a job, hated the job, BCG, didn't like it at all, wanted to quit, couldn't quit. So during that time, I think I deepened a lot as a person because I was regretting my choices, and then then feeling that I made the right choices. So I think Johnny Gone Down was kind of a culmination of that idea that, that make mistakes of ambition, not mistakes of sloth. That particular quote started the whole novel.
I see. So
that always make mistakes of ambition and not mistakes of sloth.
So where did that quote come from?
Macaulay. It's a Macaulay's quote, but that quote kind of like became my life. Keep making mistakes of ambition. They are much better than not, than the mistakes of sloth, which means do not.
So it validated the mistake that you made, which was as a mistake of ambition in a way.
Exactly. Yeah. Because I was like, it was ambitious to be like, I'm going to take a year off. It was unfortunate that I came back during a recession. Like, but I could have predicted, because when I left, the economy was booming. And then when I came back, Lehman was crashing. Mm-hmm. So it was just like but in retrospect, so the journey was like that. And that's why I think that novel has really been a very cult hit in India.
Mm-hmm.
The first novel, I would still say, is still sold, like, well, has sold 100,000 copies, but I think Johnny has a very deep following.
How much did that sell? You never mentioned
much,
it anywhere.
Actually, I would say 50,000-60,000 copies. I put all my figures in some blog post. I've written everything about how much money I made, how many copies I sold, because the amount of lies that are propagated in this industry are shocking for me. Like, just shocking. Mm-hmm. Like, everybody's saying they're a best-selling writer. And when I look at the numbers, I put up a post somewhere in which I said I've done the whole analysis.
Yeah.
Nobody's selling any copies, and like, it's all lying. So don't like buy the lies. And this is how many copies I've sold, how much money I've made.
Yeah.
So
one thing I really liked in that post, I read that post about how much money you made. It was to the order of 100K in each one. The latest one was 85K, I believe. The one thing I liked was you had a column for speaking fees for Max's discontent, and it said TBD. So I like your vision of where you are seeing yourself going.
Because, I mean, in India, you do get some opportunities. Like, you get a lot of opportunities once your books start to do. But I always felt key I wasn't ready, that I wasn't ready to share any wisdom. So I never took any speaking gig. But now I feel like, you know, I can share some ideas about some things at least.
After Johnny Goes Deep, it was in 2010 published, yeah. Right? And you did it part-time, or you wrote it part-time while working in your corporate job, right?
Yeah, that one I took a sabbatical for a short time, 3-4 months. Small mini sabbatical.
I see. And where did you go and what was your...
Actually, that sabbatical, I was writing predominantly at my home in India. Yeah, I went back home and started. I was just writing. Uh-huh. Because I was very possessed by that novel. That idea of the novel was very, very personal and was very, like, I was very possessed by it.
Yeah. I started reading Max's Discontent. I have to put that down and get Johnny Goes Deep now. I'm really
Johnny
curious.
Johnny Gone Down is very, have a look at the reviews. You'll be surprised by the passion one way or the other.
Yeah.
People who don't like it, don't like it. People who love it have really been like, there's a person who carries the book every day with them to work for 8 years now or 6 years now. So like, there's a lot of passion that's ignited, you know.
Why did it take such a long gap after Johnny Gone Down?
Because I just felt I was very mediocre. Because even after Johnny, which was, I thought, a very good story, my execution was very mediocre. Mm-hmm. When I looked at the novel in retrospect, I was like, this is not international publishing quality. Mm-hmm. It was rushed. It was very quick. Good idea, very good emotions, very mediocre execution. So then I was like, enough of this mediocrity, and I'm going to step up the game. I'm going to believe in this idea that a man has infinite potential. If I choose now to be the best writer in the world, I can truly become that with effort and commitment. And so then I was like, I'm not publishing till I become that excellent writer. I don't know whether the book like meets that criteria or not. And I'm questioning whether that's true or not, whether any man can truly become the best writer in the world if they choose to do so. I think everybody has their own dharma, but I set out with that mission that I'm going to be like, it's going to be the best novel that's ever written.
What was your process of getting there, or what was your plan of getting there in 2010?
2010, the plan A was that I would be unforgiving with myself in rejecting anything that didn't feel right. So if you think of, I have two novels that are very successful in India, or like, you know, by Indian standards again, in which nobody's selling more than 2,000 copies. I've sold like 50,000-100,000 copies. So the pressure to publish is very high, right? Yeah. Because the moment I write anything, I know Harper Penguin will publish it in a minute. So I was, the first kind of like criteria I set for myself was that until I felt this was excellent, I would not publish it at all. So I wrote my first draft in 2011, rejected it. 2012, I wrote the second draft, rejected it. 2013, I realized that the reason I was writing the same stuff again was because I was not deepening as a person. So then the second idea was to truly get on this adventure. The sabbatical was kind of partially driven by this idea that I truly need to deepen as a human being to write this book.
When you say rejected it, so you will take the whole pages and throw it away and write some blank page again.
Exactly. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the only thing that would be same is the overall theme and...
But then I started to realize that the reason the novel was being purely executed despite me... And then on top of that, I did read a lot of writing books for the first time. I took a bunch of courses in the city, in New York City, Gotham writing courses, very well-known courses. And I realized that I'd learned a lot about the structure, but then my ideas were still the same ideas. What's happening with like full-time novelists is that they're still repeating the same ideas again and again. Mm-hmm. So I felt I was doing that. So then I was like, now I have to truly deepen as a person. And then I quit my, you know, then we went on the whole year sabbatical.
What is your best memory of your... So at that time, you're already married, right? So when you went on the sabbatical...
No. Yeah, we were still dating.
I see.
Came back and got married, yeah.
Oh, I see. So what was your best memory of your 1 year sabbatical in 2012?
Like all of it was very magical, I think, in many ways. I think I just enjoyed spending Himalayas was very magical, because
taking,
I think
taking cold showers in Himalayas,
taking cold showers in the Himalayas, because I think there was also like after the ashram, like, so what was happening was Europe to India was very hard, physically, because we were also very goal driven, almost like we were very rigid when we started, that we would always choose the cheapest mode everywhere. We would sleep in trains. Like we were like very almost manic on that side of like that our life is too comfortable. Now we'll experience discomfort. Mm-hmm. And we were very manic about it. So it was very harsh. Like we would walk for 50 miles. It was really harsh. And then we went to an ashram in India, which was very harsh again because of like, you know, the discipline, 5 o'clock in the morning till 10 o'clock in the night, just going on and on. So the Himalayas was the first time when we were living in an ashram, but without a very strict routine. So there was, I guess, enough like tight and slack built in. So the space to really like think, like I remember just spending days thinking about why was the universe created? How did everything came about? What is God? So I remember that like intense moments of leisure to think about that, which is very beautiful.
And you were not writing or penning down your thoughts?
Nothing. Yeah, yeah. And I wasn't even thinking that it would turn into a novel, but I was just truly trying to puzzle it out. Wow. I thought meditation would give me an answer on why was the universe created, and I was just puzzling it out myself.
And you really tried improving yourself as a writer from all angles, it seems like. You did
for many years, for multiple years,
you did the course, you went on this personal journey, and you really were so driven to improve yourself as a writer.
Correct. Because I was feeling like what is the, that there has to be like transcendence in this work. Like, otherwise it's the same ego that is just allowing you to publish, get some success, like, you know, read some good reviews, but there's no, like, I can't look at this work and say it's transcendental. I can still note myself as an author. The book is not existing as an ecosystem on its own.
Yeah.
Because there is so much of an author present because he's not refined enough to become the story. Yeah.
So can you briefly say what the novel is about and how someone can get hold of it?
Oh, yeah, sure. The novel is about a banker who becomes a yogi in the Himalayas. It's part an adventure through hidden India, like, and part a spiritual transformation. Why I think the novel is a little special is because I think every spiritual novel I've read or spiritual novel is either very heavy on the message that the author wants to give, or it's like a fable in which the author is trying to communicate a message through a fable. And this is a very real story in which you will get a message, but you'll never ever feel that there is any message being given because the story is a complete ecosystem in itself. The character makes their own decisions. So I feel it's special in the sense that it combines, it's the best of like combining the entertainment and meaning that I always wanted to do.
Yeah. One other book that I see do it very, very well was Hermann Hesse's Siddhartha.
Siddhartha, yeah, which is a big inspiration for this one. Yeah. Yeah. And I wanted to write the very modern version of Siddhartha about a guy who's in this world, in this moment. Like, you know, living in New York City, in the Bronx and all that stuff. So, yeah, so I think it's a, like, I feel, yeah, the reviews are really, really, really powerful. Like, if you, like, hop onto Amazon, it's everywhere. I think it should be in every store for the most part, again. Like, it should be in every Barnes & Nobles. It should be on Amazon. I mean, it'll be surprising if you want to find it and you can't find it.
Yes, I'll leave it the link in the show notes as well. It's called The Yoga of Max's Discontent. And apart from your own books, what is your favorite book?
The truth is that, like, for me, the books I keep coming back to are the perennial literature, like, but not perennial literature, also perennial books. Like, I would read The Buddha's Journey again and again, or The Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. Those are the books that truly I would call my favorite books because they have the most recall and return value. But the books that I admire, which is a little different than the ones I read constantly.
So, admire for their writing style.
For their writing, what I try to emulate is, I like, see. For instance, The White Tiger is brilliant for me because...
Arvind Adiga,
because it makes a very powerful statement about the world, and yet it's a story which you can't put down. At no point do you feel that the author is trying to hit a message on you, like, you know. So I feel like stories with a message that are in a very fast-paced envelope are very exciting, and I see very few of them. Life of Pi is another one. They come few and far in between, in which I feel like I've melted into the story completely, and yet when I come out of it, I have changed as a human being, which is what I'm trying to do with my writing. So it's very powerful when I run into some of that.
Any business books or nonfiction books that you recommend?
I read a lot of nonfiction, honestly, like The Four Agreements. What is the latest ones I've read? 4-Hour Work Week, Four Agreements. The Millionaire Fast Lane was very nice. I felt Think and Grow Rich. Those are some of the ones that come to my mind, like are ones that I've been moved by. The problem I've seen with myself with nonfiction is that if I read too much nonfiction, I start to summarize the ideas that I'm reading in the world, and no part of my authenticity and originality gets lost. So I try to limit a little bit of my nonfiction consumption.
I see. So whatever you say you tie it back to a principle and losing the essence of the actual experience.
Exactly. And what happens is, like, when I look at my blogs during the time I've read a lot of nonfiction, mm-hmm. They seem to parrot a lot of the ideas that the world is talking about. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, like if I think of, like, one of my most popular blogs and is How to Change Your Life in 2016. That's, like, very popular. Like, a lot of people, like, love it and comment. Like, you know, it's got, just people love it. Mm-hmm. But if I look at that blog, I'm not proud of it because I really feel it's a summary of the ideas that I've
out there
that
already.
I've read. That's my nonfiction problem. But when I look at something like How to Achieve Transcendence in Your Writing, which is one of my latest blogs, mm-hmm. it's very personal and very beautiful because I don't think you'll find that idea anywhere. It's very mine. So anyway, the bigger point being, there is a problem in nonfiction that it's too prescriptive about this is the model. And unfortunately, I take it to heart. Mm-hmm. Versus those models might not be right for me. Like, you know.
I see.
Yeah.
Yeah, I will leave the link to your blog and YouTube channel as well. I've been loving your YouTube videos too. Any question that I should have asked you that I didn't?
Oh, no, I think you've gone into a lot of depth. All good. Yes, yes.
Yeah, any, I want to ask this on air for you, for others also, but anything that I can do better as an interviewer?
Oh, great question. No, I think you're amazing, man. No, I think what can you do better as an interviewer? Yeah, I think the only thing I would say is that some of the podcasts that I interviewed with, mm-hmm. they have a patented question or a patented, like, the one thing that is theirs, you know, which can be quite interesting sometimes. You know, like, again, it can be a little limiting, but if it's the last 5 minutes on...
Got it. What's like rapid fire. What is one thing?
Yeah, or something very patented to you and your theme. You know, like, I think some of them have a very patented question for their theme.
Got it. If someone listening wants to get hold of you, what is the best way for them to do so?
You know, my website, karanbajaj.com, very well-trafficked blog. A lot of people have a lot of wonderful things to say on the comments and stuff. So, and I try to respond to almost every comment. So. Sure. So it's a wonderful way. And then my list, people, when they sign up for my list, you get things from me from time to time. Yeah.
Absolutely. I'll leave those links as well. Karan, this has been such a blast. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for tuning in. To get updates on latest episodes, make sure you subscribe with your email by going over to breakingtheborders.com. If you know anyone good as a guest, shoot me an email. I will reach out to the guest, get hold of them, and ask them all the questions that you have. My email is rohit@breakingtheborders.com. Thanks again and have an amazing day.